If I were to ask you, where would you turn to find a biblical recipe for how to put sin out of your life, where would you turn to? Where would you go to find a pattern of how we should conquer sin or have conquered or sin conquered in our life? There may be many places that we can go, many places that talk about the struggles against sin and about Satan and the world. But where would you go to find an actual record of God's winning the battle for his people? And you may come up with differing things. Let me turn back to the book of 1 Corinthians for a minute, back in 1 Corinthians 10, where we are told that the things that occurred in the Old Testament are for our example, that we can find the patterns and the recipes of how to deal with certain situations and conditions. But in 1 Corinthians 10, where Paul goes through a long list of things, specifically with the wandering through the wilderness and things like that, but in verse 6, he gives an overall principle. He says, and now these things are examples to the intent that we should not lust after evil things as they also lusted. And then he goes on and he shows that the temptations that come, the problems that human beings face. So even though he is specifically talking about their wandering through the wilderness for 40 years and all of the tests and things there, it also applies to other parts of the Old Testament. So again, I ask, I don't know what you came up with, where would you turn for a good example of how to conquer and how to be successful? You know, the word successful is only used once in the English version of the Bible, only one time. In the modern, or in the more ancient versions of the English, I think some of the modern translations use it in a couple of other places. But it's only used one time, and that is in the book of Joshua. So we're going to talk about the book of Joshua a little bit today. Certainly we know that the record of coming out of Egypt and the journeying through the wilderness are highly instructive, and they're very enlightening, and they serve as great examples of God's high hand and his mighty arm and in delivering his people. But today we want to look at Joshua as an example of what we face, what we need to look at, certain points that God specified very clearly were essential to making the changes necessary. But it's interesting, in thinking back in the life of Joshua, that we know from what it says back in the book of Numbers, chapter 14, that Joshua was already a very tried and tested and proven individual. And going back to the book of Numbers for a minute, we'll see that. And the point I'm making is that even despite that, because of the example that the book of Joshua is setting for us today, that God reminded Joshua of some very specific things that we need to think about in our lives. But back in the book of Numbers, in chapter 14, is where I'm going to pick it up. You remember this is the example of where the spies had gone into the land of Canaan. And Caleb and Joshua were two of those 12 that went into the land of Canaan. And they'd looked around the land and they'd come back to give a report of what they had seen and what they needed to do. And I want to pick it up in verse 3. Of chapter 14. And wherefore has the Lord brought us into this land to fall by the sword, that our wives and our children should be a prey? Were it not better for us to return into Egypt? You know, wouldn't it be better if we had gone back to where we started from? and not worry about all these things. And but then in verse 6, pick it up in verse 6, and Joshua the son of Nun and Caleb the son of Jephunneh, which were of them that searched the land, rent their clothes. Here you have two individuals who were so upset over what their fellow members were doing that they rent their clothes out of disgust. And they spoke unto all of the company of the children of Israel and said, the land which we pass through to search, it is an exceedingly good land. And then in verse 8, a very important quality of Joshua. It says, if the Lord delight in us, then he will bring us into this land. Very important key for all of us. If the Lord delight in you, if he delights in me, then there's not going to be any question of who's going to win, who's going to be successful. But he said, if the Lord delight in us, then he will bring us into this land and give it to us, a land which flows with milk and honey. And then in verse 9 he said, but don't rebel you against the Lord. Now rebellion can come in lots and lots of forms. We're not going to go through it all today. Samuel even said that rebellion is as the sin of witchcraft. Rebellion can be in a lot of different ways. We see a lot of it in this day and age, and we see a lot of it in the world. But don't rebel against the Lord, and neither fear you the people of the land, for they are bread for us. Their defense is departed from them, and the Lord is with us. Fear them not. But then all the congregation bade stone them with stones. Boy, it seems like reading through the Bible and the Old Testament, people were pretty handy with stones. No. My father-in-law used to talk about when he was a kid down in the mountains of West Virginia, or actually in Virginia, right in the corner of it, in the coal mining towns. He said they used to have rock fights all the time down there, with throwing rocks at each other as kids growing up. Well, many times you will find that through the 40 years of wandering that people always wanted to be stoning somebody. But he says, for all the congregation bade them stone them with stones. And the glory of the Lord appeared in the tabernacle of the congregation before all the children of Israel. And the Lord said to Moses, how long will this people provoke me, and how long will this people, and how long will it be ere they believe me for all the signs which I have shown them? And so we find all the way through here that Joshua and Caleb were the exception. Turn over to verse 23 and verse 23 and 24, where he says, but my servant Caleb, because he had another spirit with him. Caleb was a unique individual, different from all of the others. And he has followed me fully. Sounds like he was a pretty good warrior, doesn't it? He'd already proved himself. And I will bring into the land whereinto he went, and his seed shall possess it. So God gave him a promise, Caleb. And we'll find also that was true of Joshua. Coming on down, just a couple of other verses to the end of the chapter in verse 30. He says, doubtless you shall not come into the land concerning which I swore to make you dwell therein, save Caleb the son of Jephunneh and Joshua the son of Nun. These two individuals who came up against all of the others, correcting the report and giving a good report of a different spirit that was among them. That different spirit was a spirit of willingness to obey, a spirit that was willing to admit wrong, a spirit that was willing to look to God for everything that they had need of. So we find that Joshua was a loyal, faithful, obedient servant. But then why would you think in the book of the first chapter of the book of Joshua that God would take so much time in pinpointing out certain needs of what Joshua was going to need as he led these people into the promised land? So I want to go over to the book of Joshua. We're not going through this verse by verse, that's for sure. So don't worry too much about getting home on time. But there are some specific points in the book of Joshua I would like to bring out in our battle against sin, in our battle against the enemy that we face. And so he says in the book of Joshua, which, by the way, you know the word Joshua means God of salvation, or God our salvation. By the way, it's also the same name as what Jesus was. I don't know why they translated Jesus, because it really doesn't mean that. But that's what modern transliterations come up with. But Jesus' name was actually Yeshua, or Joshua, which was God of salvation. You know, the word Jesus doesn't mean anything. It really doesn't mean anything as a name. But I'm not into the name stuff, so don't worry. I'm not saying that. It's just interesting that they would take that word, that name that meant God of salvation, and make it into something that really has no meaning, per se, at all. Right into the book of Joshua, chapter 1, we find where God is giving some special instructions to Joshua before he is given charge of leading the people into the promised land. And because it was such an important job, such an important mission, God reminds him a few things in chapter 1 and verse 5. And you would think that after all that Joshua had proven, that the last thing God would have needed to do was say to Joshua in verse 5, "There shall not any man be able to stand before you all the days of your life, as I was with Moses, so I will be with you. I will not fail you. I will never forsake you." But then he says in verse 6, "Be strong." Now, I would think in Numbers 14, Joshua had proved his strength, right? When they came back from the promised land as the spies, and he resisted all of them, and he was of a different spirit. But the point is for you and for me is we can never rest on the past. We need to think of what we need now for the job ahead of us. And God knew that Joshua was going to face some pretty insurmountable things. And so he said to Joshua in verse 6, "Be strong and of a good courage." Don't be a sluggard. Don't think that, you know, "Well, I'm not sure whether God's going to be with me. For unto this people shall you divide for an inheritance the land which I swore unto their fathers to give them." Verse 7, he says the same thing. In verse 7, "Only be you strong and of a good courage." Come on down to verse 9. "Have I not commanded you? Be strong and of good courage. Be not afraid. Don't be dismayed. For the Lord your God is with you whithersoever you go." Come on down to verse 18. "Whosoever he is that does rebel against my commandments, and I will not hearken unto your words, in all that you command him, he shall be put to death. Only be strong." I think the point is, we ought to be strong, okay? That being strong of character, strong in the reliance upon God, strong in that different spirit from what the others had, and very courageous, that we need to face our lives in the same way, that God has given us the challenge of overcoming some pretty hostile enemies. Just like Joshua is going to have to overcome some pretty hostile enemies, including the Anakim. I was talking to one of the women at lunchtime. You know, when they refused to go up, you know, before the 40 years of trial, they said, well, you know, the Anakim are up there. And they're too big for us. Well, guess what? 40 years later, you think the Anakim were all gone? Or did they multiply during those 40 years? Instead of maybe 5 or 6 of them, now there were a ton of them. Big guys. So the point is, we must be strong. Not in ourselves, not in our own ability, but we must be strong in the Spirit of God. We must be confident. So big point number one in our battle to conquer the enemy and establish ourselves in the land is that we must be confident. We must be bold. We must be strong. And we must know and believe in what we are doing. No timid and reticent Christian will conquer the enemy. It won't happen. We need to be in strength. Our faith and our trust must be in God, and it must be pure. Ask yourself, how pure is my faith in God? Or how corrupted is it? How diluted is it sometimes? And I know mine gets pretty diluted at times because of human nature, our own fearful nature. But we must be brave and look to God to conquer the enemy. Point number two. Know the law. Know the law. I'll go back to the book of Joshua chapter 1, and picking up the story in verses 7 and 8, where God tells Joshua, only be you strong and very courageous. Now, how do we get that strength? How do we get that courage? That you may observe to do according to all the law which Moses, my servant, commanded you. Turn not from it to the right hand, nor to the left, that you may prosper whithersoever you go. God's law is the remedy. God's law is the way. Verse 8, then, says, this book of the law shall not depart out of your mouth. That doesn't mean you shouldn't talk about it. That's an old expression that means that it better not depart from your conversation. It better not, you know, flee somewhere. It needs to be a very important part of our life and our thinking. So the book of the law shall not depart out of your mouth, but you shall meditate therein day and night, that you may observe to do according to all that is written therein. For then, and only then, shall you make your way prosperous, and then you shall have good success. It's the only place in the older versions of the English Bible that the word success is used. Now, in our modern world, we use the word success often, don't we? But God reserves it to a pretty important part. How do we have success in our life? The answer is right here in verses 8 and 9, or 7 and 8, in God's law, in the Word of God. So we must know the law. If we're going to put sin out, guess what? You better know what sin is. Right? You better know what is sin. And the only way you get a definition of sin is if we know the law. And you know, God's law is nowhere near as complicated as our laws in this world today. Nobody understands that. It's a confusing mess. But God's laws are pretty straightforward. But it is very important that we don't turn to the right nor to the left. This attitude of, well, that's good enough. That's okay. I mean, God's going to wink at that. He's not going to worry too much about that attitude. That we must recognize that God is pretty rigid when it comes to his law. He doesn't repent. He doesn't change from his law. He is rigidly righteous. You know? What about us as individuals? In overcoming sin, can we honestly say, I am a rigidly righteous person by God's living in me, by God's power in doing that? So we must saturate our lives with the law of God. Think about it. Don't allow it to leave our minds and our thinking, because prosperity comes from obedience. And so right on the heels of that, point number three, he says, meditate on it day and night. Now what does that mean? What does meditate mean? What would you do if you want to meditate on something? It does not mean, well, I'll let it cross my mind once in a while. Okay? It does not mean, well, let's think about it only on the Sabbath. It does not mean that, well, once in a while it may come to my thoughts about what something God says. I was very impressed not long ago in the United News where a very nice young man, we see him at camp up here every year, actually took it upon himself. He's just a young man, what, about 15, 16? Maybe not even that old. But he took it upon himself and he actually wrote out all the law of God longhand in a book. And then went to his minister and turned it in and let him have it. And they gave him a special plaque, a special reward for having taken the effort.
Yeah. All five books.
All five books, not just a few. All five books of the Pentateuch. Here he is, such a young man that felt it was so important for him to know God's laws that he wrote it out. Now, I'm not going to ask a show of hand of how many of us have ever written out the laws of God. I'm not going to raise mine. But it is, probably wouldn't hurt any of us to do that, would it? To do that? But I was very impressed with him. I have always been impressed with him as a young man. Extremely friendly and very knowledgeable. Just a very fine example of a young man growing up in the Church of God. So we are then to meditate on the law of God day and night. So if it doesn't mean just let it cross your mind, what does it mean? It does mean that you ponder the law, that you question things about the law, that you pose differing situations about God's laws, that you analyze it from all kinds of different directions, that you turn it over in your thoughts and in your mind as to what would happen in this circumstances and that circumstance. How would I apply this law in this situation? You muse upon it. You think about it. And it becomes a way of life. That's what meditate means. Not just, well, I'll just let it cross my mind. That's not what David did. Let's turn to a couple of scriptures about meditation for a minute. In Psalm chapter 1, in the first Psalm, if there's any one example of what meditation is, David was an example of it. I just don't think very many of us are so involved in our spiritual life that we do as much as what we should. And I'll put myself at the top of the list. That it's not as important as it ought to be. But David said in Psalm chapter 1, verse 2, "But his delight is in the law of the Lord, and in his law does he meditate day and night." Now, you don't just kind of repeat the words of the law. You think about it. Meditate on it. Over in Psalm 63, again, in Psalm the 63rd Psalm, and verse 6. Psalm 63 and verse 6. "And when I remember you upon my bed, and I meditate on you in the night watches." You know, all night long, David would think about God, think about his law, think about his life in tune with God. Over in chapter 77, just over a couple of pages, Psalm 77. And verse 12, "I will meditate also on all your work, and I will talk of your doings." So he thinks about all of God's work, what God is doing. Let's turn to, obviously, to Psalm 119. In Psalm 119. It's such a beautiful psalm. All the way through, I just pick up a couple of verses. Psalm 119 and beginning verse 15. It says, "I will meditate in thy precepts." You know, what's the difference between a precept, a statute, a law, and a commandment? Or is there a difference? You know? If we don't think about it, maybe we all lump them into one thing. But what's the difference between ordinances, statutes, judgments, and all these different things? What difference does it make? So, it's important. On Psalm 119, then on over in verse 23. In verse 23, he says, "Princes also did sit and speak against me, but your servant did meditate in your statutes." He uses a different word there. What does that mean? Verse 27, he says, "Make me to understand the way of your precepts, so shall I talk of your wondrous works." Verse 148. He says, "Mine eyes prevent me," or precede, it should be. "Mine eyes precede the night watches." In other words, I'm still awake early in the morning, "that I might meditate in your word." I don't forget God. As soon as I hit the bed, that's over. It's a good time to muse upon God's ways and God's laws. Just turn to one other scripture, Psalm 143. David repeats it over and over and over again, but Psalm 143 and verse 5. "I remember the days of old, I meditate on all your works, I muse on the work of your hands. I stretch forth my hands unto you, my soul thirsts after you as a thirsty land. Hear me speedily, O Lord. My spirit fails. Hide not your face from me, lest I be like unto them that go down into the pit. Cause me to hear your loving kindness in the morning. You don't normally think about hearing loving kindness, do you? But we hear the way of God. For in you do I trust, and cause me to know the way wherein I should walk. And then it comes on down for the rest of it. But big point number three is that we meditate on the law of God day and night. We ponder it. We think about it. We pose differing ideas, different situations. We turn things over in our minds so that we might see the depth and the intricacy of the ways of God. Joshua was told to do that, and he said here, picking it up again in verse 8, the book of the law shall not depart out of my mouth, but you shall meditate therein day and night. If you're going to be as successful as Joshua was in leading the children of Israel into the promised land, we need to be those that meditate upon God's ways and his laws day and night. For then you shall make your way, he will make your way prosperous. And then shall you have great success. Good success. So, point number four. God's laws is the way, or God's law is the way of prosperity. And it is the way to success. The only way that can be found to really have success is in the law of God, the truth of God. And because you have that foundation, that stability, that undergirding, you can face any challenge that comes up, any problem that comes up. Point number five, over in Joshua, the fifth chapter. Now, I've often thought of this, and I was kind of intrigued by it. This is the example here of when Joshua looks up and he sees the man of God, the angel there, and he poses a question to him here in Joshua, the fifth chapter, picking it up in verse 13. He says, and it came to pass that when Joshua was by Jericho, that he lifted up his eyes and looked, and behold, there stood a man over against him with his sword drawn in his hand. And Joshua went unto him and said to him, I guess if you were a army guy and you saw somebody with a drawn sword, then you might ask a question too. Are you for or against? But anyway, going on here, he says, a man was over against him with his sword drawn in his hand, and Joshua went unto him and said, are you for us or for our enemies? And he said, no. That is a peculiar answer. He asked him two different questions. Are you for us or are you for our enemies? And he said, no. Now, where does that leave you? Where does that leave you? Are you or aren't you? But it's a very important thing to understand in our quest to be like God and to overcome sin. And he says, going on down verse 14, and he said, no, but as the captain of the host of the Lord, I am now come. I'm not on your side, nor on the other side. I'm come as the captain of the army. You know, it's kind of like Abraham Lincoln one time was asked during the Civil War by one of his soldiers. He says, well, do you think God is on our side, or do you think he's on the other side? And Abraham Lincoln looked at him and said, well, really, my concern is not whether God or not God is on our side. My concern is, are we on God's side? That's the real concern, right? Well, that's basically the tenor of what's being said here. that God is the captain of the army. He is not just taking sides. He is the chief of the army, the captain of the army, the one who is leading the army. He is leading our challenges in life. Many a time when we face problems, it's because we don't recognize the answer to this question. Is God for or against us? And the answer is neither. If he is not the captain of the host of our struggle in our life, then we're not going to be successful. If we don't allow Christ to be in charge, the captain, the one who is leading the armies, then we're not going to be successful. And so he makes it pretty clear. He said, hey, no, I'm here as the captain of the Lord's host. God must not just be for us. He must be the captain of the host. I've mentioned before, sometimes I get a little bit, it's a problem anyway sometimes, and I do it myself and I hear other people sometimes do it. And I know it's not meaning, we don't mean it in the wrong way, but we'll kind of, in our prayers and things, we'll say, well, with the help of God, we will do it. My answer is no, you won't. Neither will I. It's not just with the help of God. It is with God doing the work and being the leader of the fight, the captain of the host. Not just because he's on our side. And too many times as we struggle against sin, the reason is because we just want God on our side, rather than let God be the captain of the battle, and we follow him. That's what's important. That's what's important. So big point number five is, let Christ, because Joshua was actually a type of Christ, he is the God of salvation. Let God be the captain of the hosts of the Lord's host. When he is captain, then he will do great exploits. And he will change a lot of things. And we could read the whole account in Joshua chapter 6. Remember the story about how they came up against the city of Jericho, and it had all these strong walls around it and the pillars, but what did God do as captain of the host? The walls fell flat. It was just finished. Do you think God can't overcome any weakness in our lives? Is there any problem in our life that is beyond God's capability of solving? Is there anything? I don't care what it might be. If God can knock down the walls of Jericho, do you think he can't knock down the walls of any particular sin that might hold itself strong in our lives? Oh, he can. I know there are things that are, in quote, genetic. There are problems that are difficult, and some might be harder to change and overcome than others. But you know, I am not one who is convinced that alcoholism is stronger than Christ. Just not convinced of that. And I'm not here to say that they don't have problems or certain needs in certain ways. I'm not here to think that any particular problem is greater than what Christ is at all. Okay, point number six. In Joshua chapter 7, but point number six is, do not allow any secret sin to remain. Don't allow a secret sin to remain. Chapter 7 of the book of Joshua deals with, after the battle against Jericho, and there was a specific command by God, that they were not to take anything because it had all been devoted to God. It was blessed. It was totally a commitment for everything to go to the priesthood, and nothing was to be taken by individuals. And so you wind up with this one guy by the name of Achan, that he took of the devoted things that were devoted to God, and you know the rest of the story, how it led to them not winning this particular battle. Coming over verse 10. In verse 10, he says, and Joshua was pretty upset about it, that he fell down on his face and he was before God. And what did God tell him in verse 10? And the Lord said to Joshua, get up! Wherefore do you lie thus upon your face? Israel has sinned. And you're not solving the sin of Israel by lying there on your face. Get up and get at it. There's a reason why you didn't win this particular battle and why the men of Ai have smote you. Because there's sin among us. And he said, get rid of it. And verse 11, Israel has sinned and they have also transgressed my covenant, which I commanded them, for they even taken of the accursed thing and have also stolen and dissembled. Also they have put it even among their own stuff. Therefore the children of Israel could not stand before their enemies. Big key. The reason we can't sometimes stand before our enemies and our sins is because sin exists in our lives. Sin is still there, and we may be tolerating it. Perhaps we've even taken of the devoted things and hid them in our own stuff out of lust and envy or who knows what. Coming on over to Joshua chapter 9, point number 7 is that Satan is very deceptive, and he will try in every way possible to get us to make a covenant with that which we shouldn't covenant with. Remember chapter 9 of Joshua deals with these individuals who came and saying that they were coming from a far country, right? And they had taken all the pains to make sure they had old shoes on and they had old clothes on and they looked like they had come from who knows where rather than just across the border. Very close by. But Satan will do that to us. We'll pick it up in verse 4 to 7 in Joshua 9. And he says, they did work wily, and they went and made as if they had been ambassadors, and took old sacks upon their asses, and wine bottles old and rent and bound up, and old shoes and clotted upon their feet, and old garments upon them, and all the bread of their provisions was dry and moldy. I don't know where they got all that stuff when they only came from 10 miles away. But anyway, the point is, do you think Satan doesn't dress up sometimes things to make it look like it would be acceptable? So these people appeared that they were from way away, a long ways away. So what happens? They make an agreement with him. Coming on down to verse 6. And they went to Joshua and to the camp at Gilgal and said to him and to the men of Israel, we be come from a far country. Now therefore make you a league with us. And the men of Israel said unto the Hivites, peradventure you dwell among us, and how shall we make a league with you? And they said to Joshua, we are your servants. And Joshua said unto them, who are you, and from whence do you come? And they said again to him, from a very far country. And the servants are come because of the name of the Lord your God, for we have heard the fame of him and all of he did in Egypt. And so I'll make a long story short. They made a covenant that they would allow them to exist along with them. And they weren't from a far distance. They were next door neighbors. Pretty good lesson regarding sin. Don't just always take things at face value. Know that Satan will be very deceptive. And he will twist and turn any particular story to make it sound good. Point number 8. God is the one who gives us victory. God is the one who gives us victory. Over in the chapter 24 of the book of Joshua, the 24th chapter of the book of Joshua, beginning of verse 12, and we'll read a little bit of this, verse 12 to 17, where Joshua is reminiscing with them certain things that had gone on. He says in verse 12, talking about God here, and I sent the hornet before you, which drove them out from before you, even the two kings of the Amorites, but not with your sword nor with your bow. You will never conquer sin on your own. You will never do it. Any more than they conquered the Amorites or any of these other people with their own sword. You know, interesting, later on in the book of Judges, I'm not going to go there, but remember when they were going out against this one city and they were to take a lantern in their one hand and they were to take, a stick, wasn't it?
Yeah,
something to hit it with in the other hand. Now, if you got a lantern in this hand and a club in this hand, where are you going to put your sword to do your own fighting? You don't have any place for it. You don't have three hands. So when they went up against this battle, both hands were occupied. And God says, when you face the enemy, when I give the shout, you take this right hand and you hit that lantern with the club. And guess what happened? They all got confused. And they all got disoriented or whatever else they did. And they all fled. A pitcher, yeah, So, God gives us the victory. So he says here the rest of the way on through Joshua 24, coming on down. Verse 13, and I have given you a land for which you did not labor, and cities which you did not build, and you dwell in them, of the vineyards and oliveyards which you didn't plant. Now therefore, fear the Lord and serve him in sincerity and truth. Interesting terms. I think you will find those same two terms used back in the book of 1 Corinthians chapter 11. I doubt the days of unleavened bread that we are to serve him in sincerity and in truth. And put away the gods which your father served on the other side of the flood and in Egypt and serve you the Lord. And if it seems evil unto you to serve the Lord, choose you this day whom you will serve, whether the gods which your fathers served that were on the other side of the flood, or the gods of the Amorites in whom land you dwell. But as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. Joshua, all the way through the book, knew his confidence. I mean, after all, God had tested him a lot on this. Who are you going to serve? Are you going to allow me to be the host of the army? Or are you just going to want me on your side? My question for all of us is, do we want God just on our side, or do we want God as the captain of the host? The captain of the host. And can we make the statement, as Joshua did, for me and my house, Christ is the captain. He is the captain of the host. Now, there are many other New Testament scriptures. Let's turn back to New Testament examples of this also in our lives. So we have the example of Joshua in the Old Testament, but what can we learn from certain statements in the New Testament? First of all, go to the book of Ephesians, chapter 4. Ephesians, the 4th chapter, and verse 8. And wherefore he says, when he ascended up on the high, he led captivity captive, and he gave gifts to men. When Christ went back to God, he led captivity captive. As host of the armies, he led it captive. He's the one who overcame. He is the one who gives us the victory. Over in chapter 6 from verse 10 of Ephesians 6 and verse 10. And finally, my brethren, be strong in the Lord. Didn't that remind you of what he said to Joshua way back in Joshua chapter 1? Be strong in the Lord. I don't know what... what degree can any one of us say we are strong in the Lord? That will be individual, every one of us. But I dare say that none of us are as strong in the Lord and in the power of His might as we ought to be. I'm sure we're not. We still trust in our own selves far too much. Going back over into 2 Corinthians chapter 10, again, as captain of the hosts of the armies of God. But in 2 Corinthians 10 and verse 4, it says, for the weapons of our warfare are not carnal, but mighty through God to the pulling down of strongholds. Do you think Jericho wasn't a stronghold? It was a powerful city with walls pretty thick. And when God wants to do something, the walls fell flat. But he says, verse 5, that we are casting down imaginations and every high thing that exalts itself against the knowledge of God, and bringing into captivity every thought to the obedience of Christ. Now that's the captain of the army, the captain of the hosts of God, leading every thought into captivity. Back in Hebrews chapter 2. Hebrews, the 2nd chapter. What kind of a captain do we have in our lives today? As the captain of the hosts of God. Hebrews, the 2nd chapter, and I pick up verse 9 and 10. But we see Jesus, who was made a little lower than the angels for the suffering of death. You realize today that Christ has already risen. He's not dead anymore. You know that? He was resurrected a few days back. He came out of that grave. He returned to the Father. He is there at the right hand of God as the captain of the hosts of God. But we see Jesus, who was made a little lower than the angels for the suffering of death, crowned with glory and honor, that he, by the grace of God, should taste death for every man. For it became him for whom are all things, and by whom are all things, and bringing many sons into glory, to make the captain, interesting, you get the same term again, Christ is the captain of their salvation, perfect through suffering. Do we allow Christ to be the captain of the army, or do we just want him on our side? Which is it? Which is it? Coming on down to verse 14. Forasmuch then as the children are partakers of flesh and blood, he also himself likewise took part of the same, that through death he might destroy him that had the power of death, that is, the devil, and deliver them who through fear of death were all their lifetimes subject to bondage. For verily he took not on him the nature of angels, but he took on him the seed of Abraham. Wherefore in all things it behooved him to be made like unto his brothers, that he might be a merciful and a faithful high priest in things pertaining to God, to make reconciliation for the sins of the people. For in that he himself has suffered, being tempted, he is able to succor them that are tempted. He will be there. He won't forsake us. He won't give any expediency to Satan whatsoever. Over in chapter 4 and verse 14, final verses. In Hebrews 4 and verse 14 and 15, or through 16, it says, seeing then that we have such a great high priest, and I'll add, and a great captain of the hosts of the Lord, that is passed into the heavens, Jesus the Son of God, let us hold fast our profession. For we do not have a high priest which cannot be touched with the feeling of our infirmities, but he was in all points tempted like we are, and yet without sin. It's an amazing statement. That he managed to go through any possible thing that we can ever think of feeling, all without sin. So, because he is that kind of a captain, he says, let us therefore come, and here we find this word again, which we started with back in the book of Joshua, let us come boldly, confidently, total trust in God, unto the throne of grace, that we may obtain mercy and find grace to help in time of need. Joshua led with the people, children of Israel, because Christ was there as the host of the army. We can enter into that promised land, into the very family of God, the kingdom of God, if we allow God, make God, trusting God as the captain of the hosts of God.